You can't pay, no money can exchange hands. You can't pay a tutor or a babysitter or an educator or even cover expenses for snacks. So there could be no pay that exchanged hands. Other examples were in some states, I think it was Illinois, said that these pods had to be licensed as state-licensed childcare centers. In other states, there were limitations on the size of your pod and the scope of what that pod could be like. You had to register in your district if you had a pod. And again, these are what we would have called, you know, play groups. Pre-pandemic, right? These are families with kids getting together in these small groups.
Hey, everybody, and welcome back to the show. We're tackling an interesting topic today, homeschooling and education. And my guest is Carrie McDonald. She's a senior education fellow at the Foundation for Economic Education, where I also work. And she's the author of Unschooled, Raising Curious, Well-Educated Children Outside the Conventional Classroom. Carrie, thanks so much for coming on the show.
Oh, I'm so glad to be here, Brad. Thanks for having me.
So I'll be honest, when I first joined FEE and started reading your work, I just didn't really know very much about homeschooling. I hadn't thought about it a whole lot, or I wasn't homeschooled. None of my close friends were, but people that I've met have been. But so maybe for people that aren't very familiar with it, could you just kind of give us a layman's definition of what counts as homeschooling and then some examples of what that looks like in practice?
Right. So I think many people are much more familiar with the idea of homeschooling, certainly over the past year. But even before the pandemic response and the school shutdowns, homeschooling had really moved from a sort of marginalized or fringe movement into the mainstream. The basic definition are parents removing their kids from school and directing their education themselves, most of the time using all kinds of different resources and learning tools. So the kind of stereotype of a parent, typically a mom, sitting around a kitchen table going through textbooks is really a caricature, certainly of modern day homeschooling. I'm not sure that it was ever really true, but certainly not true in the 21st century. But just to give a little bit of a flavor of kind of the history of the modern homeschooling movement, of course, prior to the 19th century and the passage of compulsory schooling laws, beginning here where I am in Massachusetts in 1852, homeschooling was the default. Most families, had the expectation that they would teach their children, certainly in the younger years, and then they would use an assortment of tutors or private schools or what were called dame schools, which were schools in your neighbor's kitchen before those became regulated away. So homeschooling was really, since the country's founding and even in the colonial era, the dominant way that Americans were educated. And it sort of fell out of favor from the late 19th century into the middle and later part of the 20th century, really beginning its kind of modern boom in the early 1970s. And it began in the kind of hippie movement on the left. So it was sort of these hippies living on communes, deciding to be anti-establishment, take their kids out of school, teach them themselves in this very free flow way. And that's where it began. And then it gained traction in the conservative right, mainly conservative Christians, evangelical Christians, which is where a lot of the population growth in homeschooling came throughout the 1980s and also helped to establish kind of the regulatory structure to enable homeschooling to become legally recognized in all 50 states, which it did by the mid-1990s. And the first year that the U.S. Department of Education began tracking homeschoolers was in 1999, and they counted 850,000. But over the course of the following decade, the number skyrocketed so that the latest federal data we had kind of pre-pandemic from the U.S. Department of Education was 2016, showing about 1.7 million homeschoolers, or about 3.5%. of the U.S. K-12 school age population were homeschooled, and increasingly reflected sort of the larger demographics of the U.S. K-12 school age population as a whole.
So you mentioned the pre-pandemic data, and that's really interesting because I've been reading your work lately at fee.org, where we both write and work, And you've covered a lot about the explosion in homeschooling during the COVID pandemic. I mean, if there was any period of time to show even non-political Americans the failings of the public school system, I think the last year has been it, right? These schools that already were full of problems to begin with were shut down with no basis in science, kept closed by teachers' unions. You've got disastrous mental health consequences and academic gaps from that. But one small silver lining that you've written about is a huge uptick in homeschooling, right?
Right. So I think the larger silver lining is parental empowerment more broadly. See parents put back in charge of their children's education in ways that they never had been before. They got a much closer look during remote schooling last spring at what their kids were learning in their classrooms or what they weren't learning in their classrooms. And I think it was striking for a lot of families. You also had a lot of families who maybe were dissatisfied with the current classroom environment that their kids were in, but kind of lacked that catalyst to make a change. And again, the school closures and pandemic response provided that opportunity to look at some other options. So overall, I think it's been a year, certainly of parents being back in the driver's seat of their children's education. I know you've talked to Corey DeAngelis before in your program, but in increasing support for education choice policy, now over 24 states having active school choice policy legislation to provide parents with more options to choose the best learning environment for their kids. But yeah, when the school shutdowns began last spring and you had roughly 50 million US school children suddenly displaced from their classrooms learning at home, you know, it was sort of, I wrote for Forbes, for example, about kind of the world homeschooling moment. We had over a billion students worldwide displaced from their classrooms at the peak of the pandemic response. But it is a little bit misleading because, of course, what most students were doing last spring and continue to do in many districts across the country now is really just remote schooling at home. So they're still tied to their school district. They're still tied to whatever expectations and curriculum assignments are being given out through their school or their district. And, you know, typical homeschoolers would tell you it was nothing like, and it's been nothing like authentic homeschooling when we are typically immersed in our communities and in the people, places, and things around us with museums and libraries and classes and mentors. And of course, none of us have really been able to do that to a large degree over the past year with lockdowns and other kinds of pandemic policies. But still, what I thought was really interesting is even as we were all, as parents were all sort of thrust into this emergency homeschooling situation last spring, and even those of us who have homeschooled found the process to be really challenging as all of a sudden all of these classes and programs were shut down for us too. About a month into these school closures, EdChoice did one of the first surveys finding that more than half of parents had a more favorable view of homeschooling in light of the pandemic response than they had before. And just recently, they came up with new data to show that that's increased even more. It sort of increased steadily every month since they began to track these parent perspectives last April. So that's a great sign. And again, I find it really fascinating that if parents think this kind of homeschooling is working out, just wait for the real thing when we can be, again, immersed authentically in our communities and in these great resources around us.
Yeah, I think it's interesting, that point, right? It doesn't seem so outlandish when you're already doing homeschooling, but with it separate, right? Like the schooling from the public schools and the teachers' unions remotely at home. I'm not a parent, but I imagine if I was and I was watching some of the things my kids are being taught over Zoom, I'd be like, hey, they're already here. I'm already watching them. I'm already feeding them. I can do this better than these people over Zoom, you know, dark backgrounds a few hours a day with, from what I hear, distance learning has been a total mess from everything I've seen and read in a lot of these school districts. So I guess that brings us to the new census data that you just wrote about, saying that homeschooling population has tripled since before the pandemic. But one part of that particularly that interests me in your latest article is the notion of the, I guess, what would the stereotype of homeschoolers, you know, the upper middle class, white family. Critics make that caricature, but according to the census data, that's not actually who is driving this boom.
Right. If I can just step back a little bit before we get to the census data and then and to your larger point of who's really driving the increase this year, there were hints even last summer that homeschooling was going to be big over the fall and certainly into this academic year. For example, in North Carolina, the first week of July was the week that parents could register to homeschool their kids in that state. And there were so many parents who logged in to register their intent to homeschool that first week that it crashed the state's education website. So there were already these inklings, and then NPR was picking up on many stories about homeschooling up, you know, 25-30% in some states in terms of applications. So there were these hints that independent homeschooling, parents unenrolling their children from a school or district, was going to be certainly, you know, a positive trend, and we're going to see some increased numbers. And then the first kind of meaningful poll to capture this was in August, when Gallup found that about 10% of families were planning to homeschool this year, which was double their survey results from the previous year when they counted 5%. Then a couple months later, Education Week did a similar survey, and they calculated that it was about 9% of families were homeschooling their kids independently this academic year. Interestingly, the Education Week piece that wasn't really picked up as much in the census poll that we'll talk about in a minute, but the Education Week piece found that low-income families were the ones more likely to be choosing homeschooling during this academic year. And in fact, it's true that even pre-pandemic, the average homeschooler is not affluent. So, you know, there's sort of this myth, and I think we'll talk about myths later, but there's sort of this myth that it's these kind of affluent or well-to-do families who are able to homeschool, and that's simply not the case in terms of historic numbers or numbers that we've seen during the past year. So this all sets us up to the census data that came out last week, finding that there's been a tripling of homeschooling numbers since the pre-pandemic. So they counted 11.1% of U.S. K to 12 students now being homeschooled, and this was up from about 5% that they counted last spring, and up from that kind of 3.5% that we had kind of pre-pandemic based on that Department of Education data. So just enormous growth in homeschooling, I think, again, to be expected over the past year, but also maybe recognizing that that U.S. Department of Education data from 2016 might have been a little bit low too. So it's hard to say exactly, but certainly over the past 5 years, we could probably honestly say that there's been a tripling in homeschooling numbers. And the growth in terms of what the census data found, the growth in homeschooling is really being driven by, in particular, Black homeschooling families that saw a five-fold increase. Now 16% of Black families are homeschooling, and that's above the 15% representation of Black students in the overall K to 12 school population.
Yeah, that was a really interesting data point that jumped out to me, because it seems like the students, like you said, low income and minority students who are disproportionately failed by our public schools are the ones whose families seem to be taking even more advantage of this paradigm shift. But one thing that interested me is kind of homeschooling, from what I've read of your work, has always been a co-op based thing in many cases. It's not just you teaching your kid at home and they never leave the house, right? Other homeschooling families get together, they do field trips, they do all sorts of collaborative things. But can you talk about how that has emerged in the COVID era as pandemic pods? A lot of people have maybe seen that term in the headline, but basically, what is this phenomena?
Right. Well, I often say, pre-pandemic, my kids typically spent more time outside of our home than inside of it, taking classes in our community. We live in Boston, Massachusetts, lots of museums and programming for homeschoolers, as well as these community groups of other homeschoolers, certainly during the day. And I think you're right that this kind of time-honored homeschool co-op model that, of course, has existed as long as the modern homeschooling movement, has had renewed interest with the kind of emergence of these pandemic pods or these learning pods that have sprouted in response to the pandemic. And this term really came on the scene last summer, again, as I think families were starting to think about what the fall would look like. They were looking at back to school reopening plans or not reopening plans with remote schooling only or some hybrid models. They were looking at some of the social distancing requirements and other CDC guidelines that were being implemented in schools, many of which they you know, maybe not have weren't satisfied with, or maybe they still had anxiety about the virus itself. And so they started to gather it, families all across the country really started to gather with others to find like-minded families and say, you know, how about we allow an opportunity for our kids to get together safely to have some social interaction? And at this time, you know, this was a moment where we were kind of coming out of the spring peak of coronavirus cases. And in many cases, kids hadn't seen other kids for a couple of months. And I think parents were saying, gosh, you know, we need to provide some opportunities for our kids to get together with other kids. And so they started to form these small groups. And then those sort of emerged into what was going to be a fall learning pod for many of these families, where families would either take turns rotating from house to house and maybe take turns teaching their kids or facilitating a curriculum, or they would hire an educator, a college student or a teacher or tutor to facilitate a curriculum. And some of these learning pods were independent homeschooling pods where parents had removed their kids from school to create these independent pods. And in other cases, they were families whose kids were still enrolled in a district school, but they wanted their kids to interact daily with some other kids and to have that kind of in-person touch that they weren't getting with remote schooling. So in those cases, they were doing the remote schooling tied to their district, but they were doing it in these small groups. It's such a wonderful example of spontaneous, parent-driven, decentralized enterprises, really, of parents and educators kind of meeting the demand for in-person learning that was safe and that was engaging and a good experience for parents, educators, and children alike.
Yeah, it is. It is really a cool example of how when you have a problem and you leave it to the lowest level, decentralized across every family, they can come up with solutions that work for them. But whenever something like that happens, there is often an equal and opposite response from government busybodies and bureaucrats saying, no, stop the fun. That can't be allowed to happen. So I was kind of surprised, but I'm more cynical than that. But I was disappointed to hear and read about the move in some states and localities to regulate or crack down or restrict pandemic pods. Can you tell us about that?
Right. So just as these pandemic pods were really gaining traction in a lot of places and families, you know, excited that this was going to be a good fix for them and maybe a way to get through the next academic year more successfully than the spring had been, the state started cracking down in many cases. States across the country started issuing their pandemic pod or learning pod regulations. Now, I will say that in some cases, this was parent-driven as well. So, for example, here in Massachusetts, it was a lot of parents saying, we want to create a pod. What's the state going to let us do? And so they were sort of looking for permission. And then the state, you know, stepped in and issued these guidelines. So, you know, in some cases, it was, I think, this sense that we need to wait and see what the state will allow us to do, as opposed to recognizing that as parents, you know, you can gather with whomever you'd like. It's your home and it's your children. And if you are all engaging in sort of this voluntary exchange and voluntary association in a peaceful way, then the state shouldn't be involved at all and you shouldn't need that permission. But I do think that that was part of the driver in this. In particular, a lot of parents whose kids were still enrolled in the district school, but they wanted that that pod experience where kids could be together doing that school remote learning. And that's where I think a lot of these regulations came from. Now, in a lot of states, the pandemic regulations that came down were really geared at, again, parents whose kids were still enrolled in the district school. And some of these regulations said, for example, you can't pay. No money can exchange hands. You can't pay a tutor or a babysitter, or an educator, or even cover expenses for snacks. So there could be no pay that exchanged hands. Other examples were in some states, I think it was Illinois, said that these pods had to be licensed as state licensed childcare centers. In other states, there were limitations on the size of your pod and the scope of what that pod could be like. You had to register in your district if you had a pod. And again, these are what we would have called, you know, play groups pre-pandemic, right? These are families with kids getting together in these small groups.
Black market play dates.
Right. But now all of a sudden need to be authorized by the state. But I think it's important to really make the note. One of the things I emphasized at the time that these pandemic pods really came on the scene was that the regulations in many cases existed, and they shouldn't exist at all, but in many cases they were geared towards, again, parents whose kids were still enrolled in the district school. And so I said, you know, again, it's a plug for independent homeschooling, for unenrolling your child from this school, and then you know were not necessarily in many cases required to follow these pod regulations. But I think that there's still concern about that. And that's why I love it. And the recent fee.org article that you are mentioning about the census data, there's some legislation, school choice legislation in Pennsylvania that includes an aspect that would really protect all of these learning pods, independent or school related, making sure parents are not subject to increased surveillance or regulation, making sure that they're not harassed by you know, district officials, and that they can really operate autonomously.
Yeah, that is important. And if they go that route, that is, unfortunately, I want to shift gears and talk about something kind of interesting and kind of alarming. But even if you did want to pursue the independent homeschooling route, there are some people out there who want to make that illegal. And I want to discuss that with you. I will say that is not the mainstream Democrat view, the mainstream progressive view. But it is, unfortunately, the view of a Harvard professor who you have debated and gone back and forth with. Who argued that homeschooling should be banned, right? And so can you tell us what this theory is and where it's coming from?
Right. So last spring, as the whole world was suddenly schooling at home or displaced from their classrooms, we learned about Professor Elizabeth Barthollet at the Harvard Law School, who wrote an article for the Arizona Law Review that was then discussed in Harvard Magazine, the alumni magazine of Harvard University, calling for a presumptive ban on homeschooling. And she laid out in this lengthy Arizona Law Review piece, and then again in the more condensed Harvard Magazine piece, you know, her reasoning, basically saying that homeschooling should be very limited, that kids must be have some connection to a public school, that even if the state grants them permission to homeschool under her regulatory regime for homeschooling, even if they get permission to homeschool their own children, that they would still have to send their kids to the local district school for certain classes and certain activities that she would recommend these home visits by school officials and maybe even Child Protective Services officials to make sure that kids are okay being with their parents. It was just such a sort of a breathtakingly expansive proposal to infringe on the parents' right to educate their children as they choose, and certainly on homeschooling rights in particular. So my first foray into debating Professor Barthollet was I wrote a response to the Harvard Magazine article. I went to graduate school in education policy at Harvard and wrote a letter to the editor as an alumna saying why I thought Professor Barthollet was misguided and how I felt that she had a really outdated, stereotypical view of today's homeschooling families that was not at all characteristic of what homeschooling families are like in the 21st century. And so I laid out some of those examples and then continued to write additional articles as the word got out in other periodicals about Professor Barthollet's proposals, and then had a wonderful opportunity to debate Professor Barthollet live through the Cato Institute last June, really laying out why I thought that her views about homeschooling and in particular her proposal to have a presumptive ban on the practice were, you know, ludicrous.
Yeah, that whole saga really kind of blew my mind out there. But I do want to shift gears slightly and just talk about some of the myths or concerns that people would have when they hear about the idea of homeschooling. So one thing that I've heard and that comes to mind is the idea of if kids are being schooled at home by parents, not everyone has great parents like you or like many other homeschooling parents. I know, but for my example, I have one good and competent parent, my mother. But my dad's not in my life at all. And when I was a teenager and I lived with my dad and my stepmom, was really not, I guess you would say, a competent or suitable living environment for a teenager. And if they had homeschooled me, I would have been neglected, most likely, I would say. So I guess what safeguards are in place to make sure that no kids fall through the cracks if they're taken into homeschooling?
Well, first, I would say it would probably be unlikely that your dad would have chosen to homeschool you. And of course, he didn't. And I think that's part of it. You know, you already have kind of a self-selected group of families choosing to homeschool. And the number one reason that parents today choose to homeschool, according to Federal Department of Education data, is concern about the environment of other schools, including negative peer pressure, bullying, drugs, all of these kinds of what we call kind of negative socialization experiences. So that's the top reason that most families choose to homeschool. That's followed by a desire for a more rigorous or more successful academic environment for their children. So if we think about those as kind of the primary motivators for today's homeschooling families, these are, you know, self-selected groups of parents who really want the best education for their kids. They don't feel like they could get that in a conventional classroom, public or private. And so they're willing to really kind of customize a much more individualized education plan for their children. And with so many of the resources available, particularly today, it's easier than ever before to homeschool your kids. Maybe we'll get to this too, but I think another myth of homeschooling is that, well, you need to have one parent home at all times to be kind of the full-time homeschooling parent. And that's not true. My husband and I both work, for example, and that's true of many families. I think that will be even more true now as remote learning and remote working becomes you know, much more acceptable and widespread in our culture, that there are these sort of flexible work environments that enable families to then give that same flexibility and learning to their children. And there are these incredible online learning tools. You know, I think one unfortunate outcome of the school closures and the remote Zoom schooling that we've experienced over the past year is it gives sort of virtual learning a bad name. And I hope that we can dispel that myth as well, because while remote district schooling might be a disaster with high levels of failure and kids really just not learning much at all in many cases, high quality virtual learning that's intended to be such, when you have these private providers of online learning resources or tools, for example, like Khan Academy, which is free online learning videos, in particular, they're known for their math programs for all levels, elementary and secondary school. These are fantastic resources for learning that are online. And I think a lot of families realized maybe that they never did before, that they do have access to these incredible tools that can help their children learn, and that their role really as homeschooling parents is to facilitate that learning, not necessarily to be, again, sitting at the kitchen table directing it.
So I guess that brings up one other thought is with public schools, I can't say it works terribly well, or private schools or charter schools, there are open metrics, test scores, graduation rates, and then there's some effort made of quality control. Are they doing a good job? I think obviously with public schools, that's not always followed through on, but is there a system of quality control for homeschooling? How do we know which parents are doing a good job, which ones aren't, if any are giving kids a really subpar education?
Yeah, so the peer-reviewed research that has been done shows that homeschoolers generally outperform their school peers, that they don't have problem adjusting to college should they choose to attend, that they do attend college at high rates or comparable rates to school children. Lindsay Burke at the Heritage Foundation did a literature review of all of the homeschooling outcomes, academic outcomes, and found that homeschoolers excel academically and have no problems again, surpassing their peers that are in school. So I think a lot of, again, those concerns are unfounded. And then, you know, if we compare that to the dismal academic results that we're seeing in public schools across the country, you know, homeschoolers are really outshining, in many cases, their school peers. And I think in particular, if you look at the standardized test results in public schools, particularly for students of color in many cases, in many districts, they're abysmal. And that could also explain why we've seen not only, according to the Census Bureau, an increase in homeschooling rates in all races and ethnicities over this past year, but even pre-pandemic, we saw, for example, a doubling of the Black homeschooling rate between 2008 and 2012. We saw, you know, skyrocketing rates of Hispanic homeschoolers, I think, as parents realize they can do a better job than these district schools.
So one other thing I wanted to ask you about is there is kind of the stereotype of the socially awkward homeschooled kid who is like cringy in social interactions because they spend a lot of time at home. And I only know a few people. One of my good friends is homeschooled. I didn't learn that till like a year after Matter. I never would have guessed it. So from my unscientific sample size, that's certainly not true. But what do you say to people who worry that homeschooled kids won't get enough socialization or interaction with the outside world?
Yeah, well, it's sort of interesting because my first introduction to homeschooling was when I was in college. I went to K-12 public schools and then went to college and was an economics major, but I became increasingly interested in education. So I took several education classes, and for one education seminar my senior year, I did an independent research project on homeschooling, and homeschooling had just come into the mainstream at the time. This was in the late 1990s. So it certainly, you know, really hadn't made it into what we think of as a kind of a legitimate education choice that it is today. But I was able to shadow a homeschooling family for that semester. And my first question when I walked into that family's home was, what about socialization? And then I very quickly realized that the kind of socialization that in particular this homeschool child was getting was much more authentic than the sort of forced socialization that we experience in public schools. So in this case, this child was, again, immersed in her community, had all kinds of different interactions with people of all different ages and experiences. And she had a variety of mentors in her community and all kinds of different programs that she participated in, and after-school programs that involved other kids from the community as well as homeschool programs. And again, this was in the late 1990s. Now there's just so many more homeschoolers that those experiences are much more widespread. And in many cases, certainly in urban areas like where I am, organizations and nonprofits cater to homeschoolers and provide programming specifically for homeschool children. But it was interesting, that experience, seeing that homeschool child and me saying, well, how could she possibly be homeschooled? And then watching this, again, this authentic socialization, excuse me, that she had. And then seeing that contrasted with that same semester, I was doing a student teaching practicum in a local second grade elementary school. And I think before, I never really realized any kind of this contrast between authentic socialization, the kinds of socialization that you and I would do, where we just meet people socially in the community, and this age segregated, command and control, kind of obedience focused conventional classroom that I had experienced as a child and that I was then witnessing with this second grade group. So it really, for me, made it clear that socialization happens by being social in a community, really building those relationships with our neighbors and community members and mentors. And it's not what we would think of as this age segregated classroom. And I will just add one other piece to this. Daniel Hamlin is a professor at the University of Oklahoma, and he's done research on what he calls cultural capital for homeschoolers. And he finds that homeschoolers are much more likely than their school peers to go to the library, to go to the museum, to go to a community event, a sporting event, a musical event, to go to a bookstore, to go to a zoo, than their school peers. So homeschoolers are quite connected to their communities.
All right. Well, one question I do have is, if somebody's listening to this and they're not happy with their school and they're thinking, maybe I would homeschool my child, what's like the 101 for how somebody could learn more or get started?
Well, visit me at fee.org/Carrie. You can sign up for my Parenting and Education Weekly email newsletter. And I also have a Fee Facebook group called Learning at Home to chat with other homeschoolers and parents who are maybe even just temporarily with their kids at home during this pandemic response. So start there. But I think, you know, a key thing is to realize that that it's not so overwhelming as you might think. It's not like all of a sudden you have to be the one going through the process of replicating school at home, that there's tremendous amount of resources available to you, some sort of off-the-shelf curriculum that you can get online at a very low cost, or that you can buy hard copy if that's better for you, or you can be much more a la carte with these kinds of different curriculum resources. Like I mentioned, Khan Academy for math, there's Mystery Science for science, there's No Red Ink for writing and English. So there's just tremendous resources, many of which are free or very low cost for families. So it's not as overwhelming as a newcomer to this process might think.
All right. I think that is a good place to leave the serious talk. And everybody, the links to Carrie's author page, her newsletter, and her book will all be in the episode description. So go ahead and check that out. But Carrie, now we come to the single most important part of this podcast, where we ask every guest for their most controversial food take.
All right. I love this part of your podcast, Brad, so I've been thinking about it. And I would have to say that it is microwaved Wheaties with milk and bananas.
Cereal hot?
Good stuff. Gets all mushy, warm.
That Breakfast doesn't sound champions. Particularly appetizing, but I can't say I've ever tried my cereal hot. I did have one friend in college who used to eat a bowl of cereal with ketchup instead of milk.
Wow, that might
and that's
be
pretty good. Gross. But yeah. This might be grosser. I can't decide, but I'll have to try it before I knock it. So, everybody, that is Carrie McDonald, Senior Education Fellow at Fee. Thanks so much, and we'll talk to you all again next week.
Thanks, Brad.